You're listening to Well Now, Slate's podcast on health and wellness. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. 4 years ago this week, public health around the globe changed forever.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction.
The World Health Organization named the coronavirus a pandemic, and the world as we knew it began shutting down.
To unleash the full power of the federal government in this effort today, I am officially declaring a national emergency.
This morning, California, with its 40 million people, becoming the first state in the nation to order a virtual lockdown.
Businesses across the country forced to shut their doors, already leading to absolutely stunning increases in unemployment claims.
Across the country, at least 21 million kids now home from school.
The coronavirus affected virtually every part of our lives. Hospitals were overrun, businesses shut down and let go of workers, schools went remote, and major gatherings were postponed. And after about 2 years, more than a million Americans had died.
While it seems that much of America has moved on from the pandemic, here at Well Now, we're taking the next 2 weeks to explore how the coronavirus transformed our sense of wellness as individuals and as a nation. And Kavita, I want to start this episode by asking you about the moments in your pandemic experience, specifically what stood out for you as a physician and also as a person.
Well, Maya, I have to tell you two stories, one which has actually a wonderful ending. Early on in the pandemic, because of some of the roles that I've had in the past, where I had helped on the country's pandemic preparedness planning prior to having SARS-CoV-2, or what we call the COVID-19 virus now, I had been working heavily with the FDA and other organizations on this exact scenario, not even kind of understanding it would come to reality. So some colleagues of mine, physician colleagues, had contacted me early when the pandemic had started. And it was around this time when they had contacted me and said that one of our mutual physician colleagues was in a hospital in Long Island, an ophthalmologist, and that he was hospitalized with this novel coronavirus, and that they were trying to locate some of the early treatments for which there was very little experience, but some early kind of antivirals, which now that we have more experience, we know those treatments have not worked well. And he was in an ICU dying. And despite having worked with the FDA, despite having probably some of the best connections one could possibly have, it was just that hard to try to get access to someone who met all the clinical criteria, but there were just simply too many patients. The reason this has a happy ending is because there was probably months of guilt of trying to figure out, as he was still in the ICU and essentially in a coma, trying to understand if there was anything that any of us could do. All the while, I had been counting the numbers of patients of mine who were dying and actually had other friends who died. And so during that time period, he slowly recovered. And I'm ecstatic to say that it was about 3 months ago that I was able to meet with him in person. And it's obviously changed his life forever, but what we would call now a kind of a modern medical miracle. So that's one story, Maya. And then the second story is more of a, I would say, like kind of a moment of in time and history, that after the first 100,000 patients had died, people had died of COVID-19 in the United States, and that was what we knew. There were more that we soon kind of found out that had died, but just were not counted properly. And it was the first time there had ever been kind of a candlelight vigil in Washington, D.C., with 100,000 kind of points of light. It was right around the time, actually, of inauguration. So it was January of 2021. There were a group of us kind of in different parts, still all remote and kind of isolating other than seeing patients. And I remember we were all so emotionally, like, it kind of all caught up with us. And it just, there was like this moment. And for me, it kind of played out on national TV because I had to do something on television that night. But I was so emotionally bereft that it had occurred to us that in all the like panic and washing and cleaning boxes or trying to wipe down doorknobs and counters and putting on masks and trying to find masks and trying to make sure your kids had masks, that in doing all that, we had not stopped and like honored the lives that we had lost. And so those are probably the two most poignant memories for me. What about you, Maya? What comes up for you?
Those are really deep memories, Kavita. Well, I was here in New York And so I have very, very vivid memories on, you know, the 13th of March, kind of everything in New York closing and saying to our dear friends, okay, we'll see you in 2 weeks, because that's what we believed. We didn't know on our end. And we all went in our homes, and many of our friends actually left the city. Some people, friends of ours who were international, like got on planes and moved back home. And we were in our homes, and New York City has never been so quiet. There were no airplanes, there were no cars, there were no people on the street. I live right along a subway line, so you can hear the subway from time to time. The subway stopped. It was just silence. We heard birds, and it was really eerie. And in addition to the birds, we heard ambulances just every 15 minutes roaring down the street. And it was really frightening. And I remember this went on past the 2 weeks. And then at some point in the city, there was the 7 o'clock clap for all of the healthcare workers who were going and putting their lives on the line for the people that were sick. And at this point, I remember our neighbors, this was the only time we saw each other. We would lean out of our windows or go sit on our stoops with pots and pans, and we would just clap and clang them for maybe 5 minutes, wave at each other, and then go back inside. And that was really our experience for many months. And for those of us who were able to continue working from home, I switched to virtual, and we were just inside. And Kavita, you know, one part of what I also remember was that I was in the process of doing a lot of writing about the glaring health disparities and the racial divide. And I've never had more assignments, truthfully, in my life as during COVID, just writing about what people were experiencing and talking to people and being so aware that the folks that had to go out so that we could get our groceries or, you know, continue to live were the ones that were the most marginalized and the most vulnerable and had the most diseases going into this and really ended up perishing. It was I do have a nice ending to it. I remember when my daughter and her best friend were able to see each other for the first time, and they both had gloves on, and they like touched each other's hands, and they just were holding hands with the gloves. And that was just our experience.
It's amazing, right? Years later, it's hard not to get emotional about it. But I can't help but think that there's something universal in that emotion, both the highs and the lows, that it's pretty amazing.
Completely, completely. Kavita, how for you did the pandemic change your work?
I'll describe kind of two types of work. I'm sure you can relate. Clinically, it's changed it forever for me. I have to be honest, I can't remember why I didn't wear a mask before. I certainly don't wear all the gear that I used to. I had goggles and face shield and hair shield, all sorts of shields. And now I pretty much just use people ask me all the time. I use a KN95 mask with ear loops. They're just easier to put on my head. And I don't think I'll ever take that off, to be honest, because it saved me from not getting COVID, not getting the flu, not getting many of the things that normally in a regular year. So that's probably one way. And then the second way is it's made me more intentional, because the non-clinical parts of my work have pretty much all remained on Zoom. There's just a lot of, there are good things to that and bad things. And I think sometimes the bad things is that you don't have time to connect with people and humans in person. So it's also made me intentional about trying to make time to see friends and colleagues in person whenever possible, albeit sometimes inconvenient for them or inconvenient for me. But those are two ways. How about you, Maya?
Well, it's interesting. Since, you know, the start of the pandemic, actually, I remember the last day that I left my office in person. And since the last 4 years, I haven't seen a patient in person. And everybody is now over Zoom. We have, I mean, a handful of people that are very, very high needs that we go in home for, but everything is virtual. And at the time, I was also teaching at NYU. I taught there for a decade. And I remember also the last time I stepped foot in the classroom, and then we had a huge virtual period. And then I went back, and let me tell you, lecturing twice a week for 3.5 hours with a mask on and not actually seeing, and this is something that, Kavita, I know you know with your patients, not seeing people's faces and being able to interact with them or have an idea of what's behind that mask. And yeah, so I really have stepped back from a lot of in-person activities that are related to work and spent so much time, you know, on my computer. It's a different life. And so I have to get creative, just as you said, about seeing people and being intentional to create time and space for that human in-person contact. Okay, so when we come back, we're going to hear another perspective about the pandemic. This time from an epidemiologist who was one of the first to sound the alarm about COVID and who chronicled how response to it has evolved. Stay with us. You're listening to Well Now, Slate's podcast on health and wellness. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. It has been 4 years since the WHO, the World Health Organization, named the COVID-19 outbreak a pandemic. And we're talking about it today with Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding. He's an epidemiologist and health economist, currently serving as the chair of the Department of Public Health at the New England Complex Systems Institute.
Back in January 2020, Eric was one of the first to sound the alarm that COVID-19 could become a public health crisis. He's with us now to talk about the pandemic, what we've learned and what we haven't, about our capabilities to confront a public health crisis. Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into our main discussion, Eric, we have a question that we always like to ask every guest. How do you define wellness for yourself?
Well, the wellness is not just the absence of disease, but I would say it is the furthering yourself into preventing of future diseases and illnesses and a general holistic, positive, healthy state of mind.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that, Maya. That's a good one. I like to collect the pearls of the wisdom that we have from our guests. That's a great one. Well, this is a nice segue to talking a little bit about COVID and not necessarily the absence of disease. Let's actually discuss a recent change that came from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy.
I know, I can't imagine you have an opinion about this, but as you well know and have been one of the first to kind of alert the public to, the CDC revised its guidance for isolation for COVID-19 specifically and lumping in COVID-19 with other respiratory illnesses. Eric, first, describe the policy change, and then just practically speaking, tell us what someone with COVID will need to do today as a result of these changes to protect themselves.
Yeah, this policy change, which I actually rather would call goalpost moving, because it's not actual, there's no change in science whatsoever. It just feels like we're just going to move the goalpost of what we need to do. And by goalpost, I don't just mean by guidelines, but also what CDC stands for. Basically, what they said is, instead of the previously at the beginning of the pandemic, it was 10 days isolation. And then December 2021, they went to 5 days isolation plus 5 days of masking. That was already controversial enough. But then now we are down to, they don't specify the isolation period. They just say, as long as you don't have a fever, which in itself, fever is not the strongest correlation with infectiousness whatsoever. It's just, as long as you don't have a fever, you can go out if you're feeling overall better. And that's not defined in any empirical objective terms whatsoever, overall better. And then if you go out once you're overall better without fever, then you should just take one of a list of precautions for the next 5 days. But the list of precautions is not like do this and this and this and this. It's do one of the this or more. So if they use a very specific and or language, and this list, you know, obviously includes masking, clean air, distancing, but then one of the last thing in this list is and or testing. And then, okay, you basically just do testing, but then there's no language whatsoever that says, oh, test negative, because you could test positive. All you have to do is do one of the above, which includes testing. And it says, if you're test positive, it doesn't say that you can't go out. So basically, it endorses going out while testing positive, if you read the language in a legalese kind of way. So it is clear as mud, basically.
So that does sound clear as mud. So if someone were to tell you, as you have engaged people on social media, that they're positive, what should they be doing?
Optimally, if they're positive, they're especially if they're positive on a rapid test, as opposed to a PCR, if you're positive on a rapid test, you're basically likely infectious and you should stay home. And if you must go out, I would say definitely N95 mask, definitely N95 mask. And of course, use HEPA filters wherever you can. I know not everyone has that, but at least N95 mask and avoid crowded places, but preferably stay home, right? I think that's the, you know, guidelines. I'm not trying to force people to stay home if there's some crazy urgent family need, but I think generally they need to stay home. But the CDC guideline says nothing about that whatsoever, and it's just incredibly frustrating.
I mean, I can tell you as a parent, just with regular respiratory illnesses, we know people are sending their children to school when they're ill. We know this. But with your clinical and scientific expertise, what do you think about this change? Was it the right call?
I absolutely think it was complete dereliction of duty of the CDC, because the CDC's name is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And where is the control and prevention? They're basically saying, we know the science has not changed. We know that actually, you know, herd immunity is not robust. But at the same time, you know, where is this disease prevention and control here? And if you read the guidelines, they actually say, you know, COVID is generally similar to other diseases, which is not true. There's no immunocompromising effects of these other diseases on weakening your immune system for other future infections, except for long COVID. You know, they recognize long COVID is this thing, but they completely lump them together with common cold and the flu. And again, we're back to it's just a flu thing, where there's this complete dereliction, because we have estimates that now say COVID not only causes brain fog, but dementia, Alzheimer's, increased cardiovascular disease, stroke, kidney disease, diabetes, immune damage that we've talked about, and a myriad of others. Plus, it's costing the U.S. economy $200 billion a year. If you annualize it into 10-year, you know, congressional budget estimates, that's $2 trillion. That's not like any other disease. And for them to say, you know what, just keep spreading it. $2 trillion over the next 10 years, whoop-dee-doo. And I think this is where the dereliction, it is so politicized because the science has not changed whatsoever. It just, they want to meet people where they are. But scientific guidelines, if you meet people where they are, it's like, oh, you know, drunk driving, you know, we shouldn't have absolute drunk driving. Everyone's going to drink a little bit and they might get drunk. We should limit to drunk driving to one drunk driving per month or something like that. And like if the CDC put out guidelines like that, that's actually what the CDC is equivalent in saying now. CDC needs to put down the gold standard of what the science is, and especially on the greater public health impact. So just because you're not coughing or febrile now, we have to think of the long term in terms of long COVID risk, your long term disease risk. And that's why when you ask me, how do you define wellness? Wellness is not just the absence of disease now, but the optimal prevention of disease in the future. And this is a complete abdication from the CDC with these guidelines.
All right, Eric. So, you know, I'll try to take a bit of a kind of friendly contrarian, but you and I both know that the CDC can make recommendations to federal and state governments, and the states can decide what they want to do. And in this case, The CDC has cited, and you and I have discussed this outside of this podcast, that the states of Oregon and California had already put what we just described into place, and that according to them, it's working just fine. And so, of course, we do have this data. And as that goes, there's so many other states that have already been acting as if the pandemic either didn't occur or wasn't much of a problem anyway. And so really, how much of a difference would it have made if the CDC had kept that language that it had previously around 5 days of isolation?
First of all, they cite Oregon and California. First of all, Oregon has gone through four health directors in the past year. So their actual messaging of these guidelines, I doubt if you poll most Oregonians, they even know about that Oregon policy that was instituted last year. California, they didn't even institute this end of the 5-day isolation thing until January 9th of this year, literally, you know, less than 2 months ago, which is like at the tail end of Christmas and New Year's. And after this past winter wave has already peaked. So basically, if you institute something after it's already peaked, it's just complete junk noise in the data. You're not going to see it because there's already a precipitous drop concurrently with it. And one thing in epidemiology, I was warned years ago when I was doing my doctorate in epidemiology, never, never, ever, ever, ever do short-term ecologic state correlation studies because it's junk in, junk out noise. And the fact the CDC relied on this and relied on such limited data, literally less than 2 months ago, and they compared a 1 month difference, it's junk science. And the CDC scientists know better. But they probably were forced to do this analysis. And, you know, I have insights. Someone inside the CDC network told me that apparently that was the main justification for their guideline change, which is absolutely ludicrous that they did such a short-term junk study to justify whatever. Because you're going to find nothing and you're going to justify, oh, we found nothing as this justification. So I think in many ways, you know, do the science, trust the data, but at the same time, you have to do good stuff. And this is where, you know, you could do junk and put it out there and the CDC can spout it off. But honestly, it could be honestly worthless because it is not good science. There's other people who've told me that CDC has put out junk politically motivated science in the past. And I think this is one of those cases in which, you know, is one of them. And again, if you poll people in California, do people in California really know about this latest policy change in January 9th? No, I guarantee 99% people don't know about it. But here we are pretending as if people all knew about it and did what they said they did and then didn't see it change. No, that's not how the real world works in terms of and how the data works.
We're going to take a break from here. When we come back, we'll talk with Eric Feigelding about how COVID-19 has changed over the past 4 years and what we should be doing to mitigate its spread now. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to Well Now. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. So we're continuing our conversation with epidemiologist Dr. Eric Feigelding. I want to talk about how the coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2 has really changed since we first saw it emerge in late December of 2019. You know, what in your estimation would you say are some of the biggest differences between the current strand of the virus versus the one that we first saw come out of Wuhan, China?
It's evolved a lot in 4 years. My God. Because, of course, back in late 2019, early 2020, the world has never seen this virus before. It's brand new, it's novel, and nobody has any prior immunity. Remember, early January, actually January 15th, WHO said there's no evidence of human-to-human transmission. Really funny. And even back in March in 2020, the WHO says, oh, it's misinformation to call COVID being airborne. It's not airborne, but we now know it is pretty frigging airborne. In fact, we now know it's majority airborne spread, but we didn't know anything. We didn't know that you could spread the virus asymptomatically Back then, they said only mask if you're feeling sick. Now we know that more than 50% of the transmission is asymptomatic. CDC even says this on their own website, which is ironic considering they say, oh, symptoms, feeling better, blah, 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 which doesn't even connect whatsoever. And so we've known a lot. We've obviously had no immunity. A lot of people, unfortunately, died in the first wave. And in the later waves, because it mutated through several generations, we had the original, there was a few minor mutations along in 2020, but then there was the alpha variant that was very infectious. And then there's a delta variant, which was infectious and severe. And then, of course, we had the original Omicron, you know, BA1, that was super contagious. Now, people said, oh, but it's mild. But yeah, because it's infecting a lot of people who already had immune system, it looks milder, but it's actually not milder. It's just that we had a lot of people vaccinated. And now we fast forward to all these super variants now that are, I think the analogy is that these variants, which are super contagious because they pierce through the veil of past immunity, where this is why we need updated shots, right? It's like previously the virus selected for what is the fastest spreading wildfire, right? And what will, you know, kill the fastest and infect the fastest. But now the virus is evolving because a lot of people have temporary immunity through either recent infection or through vaccines, is which variant is the best pole vaulter over the fence of the current immunity. So in certain ways, we're trying to build a new fence with these new shots that are a little bit higher, a little bit less porous to these pole vaulting variants, but it's a whack-a-mole. We're literally playing a whack-a-mole. We're already designing the next generation of vaccines for next winter, but it's oftentimes a shot in the dark.
So then, Eric, let's actually talk a little bit about the origins. It's pretty clear that some of the controversy in the beginning, as you pointed out, is around, you know, was this airborne? For what it's worth, I thought, how can we have such a virus that has such an impact on the respiratory system that's not airborne? And I know that you shared a lot of that concern early on. But some of the concern that's still not necessarily settled is around kind of the possible origins of the virus itself. So we've seen a number of research studies, all of which in our reading feels a little equivocal. But what do we know about where the virus came from?
Yeah, this is one of those interesting topics that is actually not one of my favorites because it's one of those things that does not have a definitive answer.
Yeah.
There is like interesting hints because if you look at the wastewater, because right now wastewater is the best indicator of COVID. Now it's well recognized that CDC even tracks wastewater. But there was wastewater signals of COVID in Europe in the fall of 2019. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, someone from China didn't bring it there already. But we've never solved those mysteries of why was it doing in Italy in October 2019, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, there is a lot of data that shows that it obviously came from the Wuhan area. But at the same time, there's no smoking gun. It's a very suspicious, there's the Wuhan Institute of Virology, but it's not a smoking gun. And also there's a conflating thing going on. It could be natural in nature, captured and studied in the lab and it leaked, but it's a leak of natural virus. And then of course, there is the bioengineered bioweapon conspiracy, right? But in certain ways, some of those on the right try to conflate them together, that if it was like studied there as a natural virus and it leaked, oh, that proves bioweapon. Or, you know, it's lab leak. To them, lab leak equals bioweapon. Well, lab leak could easily be accidental spillage of a natural virus.
Why do you think people are so, in your opinion, kind of why so much around this? Very clearly, it's important to see if this were a kind of a bioweapon. Obviously, that has incredible global implications. But to your point that no answer is really satisfactory, why has it been so important for us? And maybe from an epidemiological perspective, why is it important to know?
Right. We want to understand where it came from. Because like isolating the source of the transmission is usually, you know, we're always trying to find patient zero, right? We're always trying to find the crossover host. Because sometimes a crossover host could also give clues of how it has immunity to the virus and be able to be crossover, potentially immunity. It doesn't necessarily have to have immunity. And of course, in terms of like disease prevention, stopping the next pandemic, and do we need to beef up our biosafety levels, right? All these kind of things, which is also interesting if because SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus is this biosafety level hazard 3, which is a pretty high in terms of BSL levels. But at the same time, you know, we can spread it. So it's a very high bio lab safety level restrictions in a lab. But in public, the CDC says, you can spread it. Don't worry.
Just to review, what are the biomedical laboratory safety? There's like 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah. Well, basically, there's some basic precautions. And then each of the levels you go up, you get into more stringent, you know, in terms of air containment. Basically, it's, if you've seen the movie Outbreak, it's basically how airtight and the protocols are in terms of the safety standards. There are higher ones, but biosafety level 3 is already a pretty damn high level. And it's one of those things where the precautions necessary in a lab versus what we take in the general public, especially with the latest CDC guidelines, it's a joke.
So let's talk about that, right? So we know that masking is one of the best ways to help prevent COVID-19 from spreading. And you said, Eric, you know, N95s, right? You were pretty specific about that, you know, and we know that it also has been lumped in with other respiratory illnesses. And you also talked about this complicated, polarizing response throughout the country to vaccination. We also know that there's a polarizing response to masking. I mean, so what's your advice for keeping people safe?
Right. First of all, I want to rewind and remind people that when safety belt laws came out, oh my God, the people screaming, but my rights, my freedoms, how dare you mandate seatbelts? And again, seatbelts don't prevent crashes, but they do prevent you from getting to a more, reduces the likelihood of a serious accident. And masks, they're not 100% efficacious. And of course, they leak. And of course, it depends on how well you put it on. And I think in certain ways, people think, well, if masks work, then why do people still get sick? Then why don't they work, right? Well, in the world of public health, I tell people, first of all, that if something reduces the risk by 50%, that's actually really good. It like reduces your likelihood of getting sick by 50% or transmission by 50%. That is incredible. But people have this thing where if something is a cure or something prevents something, they think that if you do it, you won't get it absolutely with 100% efficacy. But that's not how the real world works. And of course, the mask is one of those things where it has partial efficacy, especially if you wear it properly, tight fitting, all the time, but you don't. I think in this day and age, of course, it's because it's so politicized. Not everyone wants to wear masks. I get it. They're not convenient, especially for indoor dining. But I think in those kind of situations, having clean air in the background, you know, air disinfection, air filtration, that would make a huge difference. Because I feel air disinfection filtration is agnostic of the politics of vaccination, the politics of masks. That if we had the standardized clean air as the baseline, we could potentially remove the need for masks if we had good air cleaning systems in all of our indoor environments. Honestly, we could. In certain ways, if we're going to move forward with CDC's come what may, let it spread lackadaisical policies, then we have to actually double down on the clean air, which is completely agnostic of your political and behavioral willpower to wear a mask or get a vaccine.
Eric, do you have just in terms then, let's actually talk head on about the fatigue. People are like, they've moved on. It's as if the last 4 years didn't happen, or it feels that way at times. And I'm sure that you feel that way at times. So how, you know, one, just put out a you know, wide audience, people, we are not trying to kind of identify people as being pro this, anti this. I like to say we're pro wellness and pro health on this podcast, but just give like some very, like, to kind of help us think about why we should still care. What are you telling your friends and family? And I know that people are contacting you on social media all the time asking about overcoming this fatigue. and advice on what to do. Give us like your sense of a little hopeful. Give us a little hopefulness in the closing moment.
Right. I know. I'm a very positive person.
You are. That's why I know that. Take us to a place of like why it matters.
I think in many ways that the veil of this blind following of certain messages, like back in the day, if they said there's no human-to-human transmission, says the WHO, there's no airborne, says the WHO and the CDC. And now people realize, you know, these agencies have people who are oftentimes imperfect. They didn't read the science quickly enough, absorb it quickly enough. But I think one thing we've learned is that the precautionary principle reigns supreme. That in certain ways, there is the FAFO outcome where ignore and then shit happens on the tail end. Or you could take the precautionary approach where you could have saved more lives and actually kept the society in a more functional way that we could actually come together to still go to the restaurants that we want to do had only we had these indoor air, for example. In certain ways, people now understand that their voice and advocacy in the political and policy process is so much more important than ever before. In certain ways, it's taken, I feel like democracy is not just voting. Democracy is holding your leaders accountable, advocating to fighting for what's right, because corporate lobbyists are working in the background on a continuous basis, not just on election day. Citizens must do that as well. And so I think if we elevate the consciousness of democratic activism around fighting for these health issues, it's not just what the vote is in Congress, but what we fight for in the everyday policies. I think when people wake up to that, and the last 4 years has woken up scores, mountains of millions of people to that reality, that we must fight for the world that we want to live in. I think in certain ways, that's a positive change from the pandemic.
Dr. Eric Feigelding is an epidemiologist and health economist. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Stay safe.
That's Well Now for this week. Our show is produced by Vic Whitley Berry. Ben Richmond is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. And Alicia Montgomery is Slate's Vice President of Audio.
If you have something you'd like us to cover, email the show at wellnow@slate.com. Follow us wherever you listen to podcasts and be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Join us next Wednesday as we tackle another health and wellness story. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. Thanks for listening.